This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. This is the author, Carrie Brownstein. For Corin and Janet. Prologue. 2006. I only wanted one thing on tour, to slam my hand in a door and break my fingers. Then I would go home. I had shingles on the right side of my body, brought on by stress. A perfect triangle of blisters that flickered and throbbed with a stinging electricity. At night, I could barely sleep from the discomfort, flailing about in a twin bed in a dingy European hotel room while a bandmate dozed a foot away from me. During the day, on the long drives between European cities, I rode in the back of a Sprinter van, pressed against the firm handshake of the seat, rigid and without any give. I watched DVDs of an American television show on my computer, the first season of a drama all about plotting an escape from prison. Occasionally, I glanced at my fingers and thought about how hard I'd have to slam the door. On May 27th, my band Slater Kinney arrived in Brussels, Belgium, to play a venue called Le Botanique. The shingles virus made me a loner. Janet had never had the chickenpox as a child, and thus I was contagious to her. After checking in with her sister, a doctor in L.A., the term airborne entered the conversation. But I already felt liminal and weightless, outside myself, a series of free-floating particles that only occasionally cohered into humanness, into arms and legs. Tour reassembles you. It's a fragmentary and jarring existence, even without an added illness or malady. But now I could not find the floor. I was outside the room, outside myself. The three of us hung around backstage before the show. Fluorescent lights, a mirror, buckets of ice, a picked-at deli tray. Corin gingerly helped button the back of my shirt, careful not to touch me or get too close. It's okay, I thought. This isn't my body. I'm not here. The show was about to start, and I couldn't feel a thing. Slater Kinney was my family. The longest relationship I had ever been in. It held my secrets, my bones. It was in my veins. It had saved my life countless times. It still loved me even when I was terrible to it. It might have been the first unconditional love I'd ever known. And I was about to destroy Slater Kinney. Part 1. Youth. Chapter 1. The Sound of Where You Are. I've always felt unclaimed. This is a story of the ways I created a territory. Something more than just an archipelago of identities, something that could steady me, somewhere that I belonged. My story starts with me as a fan, and to be a fan is to know that loving trumps being beloved. All the affection I poured into bands, into films, into actors and musicians was about me and about my friends. Once, in high school, I went to see the B-52s. I pressed myself against the barrier until bruises darkened my ribs, thrilled to watch Kate Pearson drink from a water bottle, only to have my best friend tell me that to her, the concert wasn't about the band. It was about us. It was about the fact that we were there together, that the music itself was secondary to our world, merely something that colored it, spoke to it. That's why all those records from high school sound so good. It's not that the songs were better, it's that we were listening to them with our friends, drunk for the first time on liqueurs, touching sweaty palms, staring for hours at a poster on the wall, not grossed out by carpet or dirt or crumpled, oily bedsheets. These songs and albums were the best ones because of how huge adolescence felt then, and how nostalgia recasts it now. Nostalgia is so certain. The sense of familiarity it instills makes us feel like we know ourselves, like we've lived. To get a sense that we have already journeyed through something, survived it, experienced it, is often so much easier and less messy than the task of currently living through something. Though hard to grasp, nostalgia is elating to bask in, temporarily restoring color to the past. It creates a sense memory that momentarily simulates context. Nostalgia is recall without the criticism of the present day, all the good parts, memory without the pain. Finally, nostalgia asks so little of us, just to be noticed and revisited. It doesn't require the difficult task of negotiation, the heartache and uncertainty that the present does. Now I can't listen to some of these records alone, in my house that I have cleaned and organized, books arranged just so, sheets washed. The sounds don't hold up. In these cases, fandom is contextual and experiential. It's not that it happened, it's that you were there. It's site-specific, age-specific. Being a fan has to do with the surroundings, and to divorce the sounds from that context often feels distancing, disorienting, but mostly disappointing. I think of all the times I've had a friend over and pulled out records from high school or college, ready for the album to change someone's life the way it changed mine. I watch my friend's face, waiting eagerly for the aha moment to arrive, only to realize that my affection for this intentionally off-key singing, saggy bass sound, and lyrics about bunnies isn't quite the revelation it was 15 years ago. "You had to be there" is not always a gloat or admonishment. Often it's an explanation for why something sounds utterly terrible. Yet there is much music that survives de- and recontextualization and that needs no experiential reference point. In this case, the role of the fan is to still be a participant, and to participate is to grant yourself permission to immerse, to willingly, gladly efface and subsume yourself for the sake of the larger meaning, but also to provide meaning. It's symbiotic. My favorite kind of musical experience is to feel afterward that your heart is filled up and transformed, like it is pumping a whole new kind of blood into your veins. This is what it is to be a fan, curious, open, desiring for connection, to feel like art has chosen you, claimed you as its witness. I grew up in the suburbs of Seattle, mostly in Redmond, Washington, a once rural town that by the late 20th century was a metonym for Microsoft. Cities frequently deride or deny their outlying residents, thinking them callow. Seattle was my beacon and muse, but it was never really mine. My parents, both raised Jewish in Chicago, were quick to adopt the religion of Christmas, though I should acknowledge the transitional years wherein we awoke to scattered presents under a menorah. Poor Santa, arriving during the night with nothing to choose from but that menorah and a houseplant. Then my mother left when I was 14, seeking a cure for herself, but leaving another form of sickness and longing behind. It was a childhood of halfways, of in-betweens. Until I was in high school, every concert I attended was an event, a spectacle. My first was Madonna. She began her Like a Virgin tour in Seattle, playing three shows at the Paramount Theater with a capacity of less than 3,000. It was 1985, and I was in fifth grade. An agreement was made between my father and my friend's mom. She'd get up at an unkind hour on a Saturday morning so that we could wait in line at Ticketmaster and my dad would stay out past his bedtime and accompany us to the actual show. I had my outfit planned. I wanted to wear what any self-respecting female Madonna fan would want to wear in the mid-80s, a wedding dress. I even asked to borrow my mom's, as if she'd be as flattered as she would have been had I asked to wear it for my real future wedding. That's inappropriate, I was told by both my parents, not just in regard to the wedding garment, but also in response to my request to wear a crop top with nothing underneath it but a black bra. I didn't need to wear a bra at the time. Even fingerless lace gloves were out of the question. I ended up clad in a short sleeve, Esprit button-up covered in pineapples and other exotic fruits, an outfit that did not land me in the local paper that ran a feature on the concert, including pictures of fans waiting in line, dressed like Madonna. By the time the music began, I didn't care that I looked like a cocktail server at a beach resort. Opening the show was a group of young smart alecks who no one in the Pacific Northwest had ever heard of. They were called the Beastie Boys. We collectively booed them in anticipation of our idol. Then Madonna came out, and I remember only two things. She did multiple outfit changes, and I screamed the entire time. When my father and I got home, I couldn't sleep. I kept going in my parents' room to regale my mother with details about what songs Madonna played and how she looked. "She's high," my dad said to my mother, laughing, and I was. It was a moment I'll never forget, a total elation that momentarily erased any outline of darkness. There was light everywhere I looked. A few years later, in junior high, I saw the Faith Tour and witnessed George Michael run in tight pants from east to west and back again across the stage. From my seat on the center of the stadium floor, Michael was reduced in size, an action figure. But the experience itself was immense. The grandiosity was ungraspable. It was the Olympics. It was a mountain. It was outer space. In the middle of the show, my 14-year-old friend turned to me and said, "I want to give George Michael a blowjob." I was confused. Wasn't I there simply for the songs? To clap my hands and scream, "I want your sex!" without actually wanting your sex? But when my friend inserted desire, an actual longing and physical response, into what I thought had been an abstract idea, I had to think about the ways music really made me feel. In that moment, among thousands of people, I was lightheaded and sweaty. I could not contain a smile. My body was moving in somewhat innocent shimmies, but also in shudders, an act that certainly connotes a deeper, reflexive, ecstatic response. I turned away from my friend, nodding in agreement that yes, the reaction to this music was embodied, was intense. But I also knew in that moment that I would much rather be the object of desire than dole it out from the sidelines or perched on my knees. Yet the music I was hearing and the concerts I was witnessing were also mystifying and inaccessible. It was the 80s, and much of what I loved was synthed-out pop and top 40 music, more programmed than played. The music was in the room and in my body, yet I had no idea how it had been assembled or how to break it apart. If I wanted to learn a Madonna song, for example, I'd obtain the piano sheet music and plunk out an anemic version of it on the keys, so wholesome that I was re-virginizing like a virgin right there in the living room. I practiced David Lee Roth stage moves. Well, only one. Jump. And entered my elementary school talent show as a dancer accompanying a band of sixth graders playing Rats round and round. I remained merely a fan, an after-school bedroom lip-syncer, and a family gathering, thanks for humoring me entertainer, with no means of claiming the sounds as my own. Then I bought my first guitar and saw my first punk and rock shows. Buying your first guitar in the suburbs does not entail anything that resembles the folklore. There is not an old blues man who gifts you a worn-out, worn-in instrument with a sweat-and-blood-stained fretboard, neck dusty from the rails, possessing magic but also a curse. Rather, you go with your mom or dad to a carpeted store that smells of antiseptic, where everything is shiny and glistening with newness, where other parents are renting saxophones or clarinets for their kids to play in the school jazz band, where some other kid is being publicly denied a drum kit on account of his parents' sanity. The cheapness, the vagueness of brands, the generic aspect of it all screams, "Warehouse for the non-committal." I left with a Canadian-made solid-state amp and a cherry-red Epiphone copy of a Stratocaster. It was the first big purchase I made with my own money. I was 15. In 10th grade, a few of my friends were old enough to drive, and I started making my way out of the suburbs and into Seattle on the weekends. Some of the shows we saw were at big venues, like the Moore or the Paramount Theater. The Church, the Ramones, Sonic Youth, the Jesus and Mary Chain. But most of the time, we'd go to smaller places, like the Party Hall or the OK Hotel, and we'd see Northwest-based bands like Tree People, Kill Sybil, Hammerbox, Engine Kid, Aspirin Feast, Galleon's Lap, Christ on a Crutch, and Positive Greed. Here I could get close to the players themselves. I could see how the drums worked with the guitars and bass. I could watch fingers move along the frets and feet stomp down on effects pedals. I saw the set list taped to the floor, and sometimes I was close enough to see the amp or pickup settings. I observed the nature of the bands, their internal interactions, their relationships to one another, as much as I listened. It seems obvious, but it was the first time I realized that music was playable, not just performable, that it had a process and a seed, a beginning, middle, and end. Everyone who plays music needs to have a moment that ignites and inspires them, calls them into the world of sound and urges them to make it. And I suppose this form of witness could happen orally. Perhaps it's as easy as hearing an Andy Gill riff or a Kim Gordon cadence and knowing intuitively how that all works. Then you form those sounds yourself, with your own hands and your own voice. Or maybe you see it on a video, in footage of a musician who finally translates and unlocks what you thought was a mystery. For me, however, I needed to be there, to see guitarists like Kim Warnick and Kurt Block of the Fastbacks, or Doug Marsh of Tree People play chords and leads, or Calvin Johnson and Heather Lewis from Beat Happening, in the wholly relatable attire of threadbare t-shirts and jean shorts, enact a weird nerd sexiness, strangely minimal, maximally perverse. I could watch them play songs that weren't coming out of thin air or from behind a curtain. I needed to press myself up against small stages, risking crushed toes, bruised sides, and the unpredictable undulation of the pit, just so I could get a glimpse of who I wanted to be. Chapter 2. That's Entertainment. As a child, I was engaged in a continuous dialogue with fantasy, escapism, and performance. From conducting mock interviews with the posters and pictures on my bedroom wall, I had so many questions for Madonna, the members of Duran Duran, and Elvis, to attempting to turn the woods behind my house into a restaurant, a task that involved sweeping the forest floor and nailing planks into fallen logs that would serve as tables, to spending hours concocting and recording an outgoing answering machine message that could serve the dual purpose of functionality and an audition, to dressing up as a clown for my sister's birthday in lieu of my parents hiring a real one. I had very little desire to be present, only to be presentational, or to pretend. I was enamored with the past, the anachronistic. I didn't feel like I was misplaced and in the wrong era, it's just that my obsessions often tilted backward in time. I exalted the old movie stars. I watched black-and-white films on AMC, setting the VCR to record Dark Victory with Betty Davis, or Preston Sturges's The Lady Eve. I collected coffee table books with Cecil Beaton photographs of Garbo, Marlena Dietrich, Cary Grant, and Gary Cooper. I read Katharine Hepburn's account of filming The African Queen and bought James Dean posters for my wall. When I was about 10 years old, I saw a commercial on TV for a Time Life record collection of doo-wop songs, ordered them COD, cash on delivery, then hid when the mailman showed up with the package while my mom paid up in order to save face. Any embarrassment I caused my mother, that she momentarily had to pretend to be a suburban housewife with nothing better to do than order music off the TV to listen to while she vacuumed, and the subsequent scolding I got was worth it. Soon I could dance around in the rec room to such out-of-date hits as A Little Bit of Soap and A Teenager in Love. I didn't believe the past world was better than my present-day life, but I connected to, aspired to, the glamour, the iconic images, which seemed unimpeachable and monolithic. There was a stillness about the past, a clarity, the way it had been somewhat defined and dissected, in the rearview mirror. It was there for the taking, for the mining. The old songs, the old movies, the black and white pictures created a visual and aural time machine. It wasn't that I imagined I had another life. It was that I didn't have to exist in the here and now. It was a total freeing effacement. Yet I was simultaneously trying to forge connections with people who had a pulse, just not with people whom I actually knew or who lived anywhere near me. In the 80s, there was a currency to having pen pals, and the more exotic the location of your pen pal, the better. My epistolary cachet was not geographically impressive. I'd made friends with some kids at camp with whom I kept in touch, but they merely lived on the other side of Washington State, or 10 minutes away, but went to a different school, which might as well be across the ocean when you're young and don't have a car. The farthest the mail came for me was from British Columbia, where a girl I'd met through a soccer exchange program lived. In comparison, friends of mine were getting letters from exotic, far-flung places like France or Vietnam. They'd bring the thin, light blue airmail envelopes to school, and we'd fawn over the foreign stamps and careful handwriting. So tiny! Is that how beautiful English could really be? The way one would over kittens. A competitive spirit ensued. I thought about what could top a correspondence from Europe or Asia. Why, one from Hollywood, of course. In the back of the teen magazines I was reading, like Bop or 16, were addresses for all the film and TV stars I loved. Not home addresses, of course. More like Ralph Macchio, care of some studio or agency, or a P.O. box where you could ostensibly reach Ricky Schroeder. So I started writing letters to them. But the plan bombed. I wasn't getting letters back. Not even a stamped signature on an 8x10. The venture soon became less about competing with my peers and more about my own sense of invisibility and need for validation. I was so desperate to be noticed that I gave up on Hollywood's Brat Pack, as they were known, and started in on those I imagined to be less fatigued by fame, the stars of daytime soap operas. And those people wrote back. Jeannie Francis from General Hospital, Drake Haugesson from Days of Our Lives, Doug Davidson from The Young and the Restless, handwritten notes on postcards, smiley faces, autographs. The niceties were even more notable because what I had written to these actors were inappropriately long letters explaining how I didn't get along with my mother or about her illness, 3 or 4 pages, all of it maudlin. They could have reasonably assumed I was pitching a plotline for an upcoming season of their show. Or maybe their mailboxes were actually full of letters expressing a dissatisfaction like mine, a feeling mismatched and misshapen, at odds with a place, with a body. Maybe these actors had a bin labeled Misplaced and Transferred Hopes, where they put notes like mine. I'm surprised their gracious replies, their autographs and notes, weren't accompanied by a list of child psychologists in my area. It's true, I wanted help, but being acknowledged sufficed. A response, any response, implied that I existed, that I was not a weirdo, that I'd be okay. I could have gone to a school counselor or even talked to my parents, but I needed someone on TV or in the movies to reach out to me, not because they were famous, but because they were so far away. It was like being seen from outer space. Suddenly, I didn't feel small. I was bigger than the house I was living in, larger than my town. Thanks to them, I somehow belonged to the world. I always think about these moments when fans approach me or write letters or send messages on social media. I try to recall the sturdiness that comes from recognition. My other form of validation was through performance. Performing gave me something to do in a given moment in a room. It was a heightened way of relating to people. I could act out feelings instead of dealing with them. Few interactions didn't involve me hamming it up in some way. My sister Stacy was my first sidekick, with whom I'd record radio plays or lip-sync for our family using a cane as a microphone. If I was at a friend's house and needed to get home, I insisted on first performing a mock ballet, complete with my friend's ballerina outfit, despite having no dance training whatsoever. Cue Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. That would be followed by a juggling act consisting of 2 tennis balls and an apple to the tune of the Lovin' Spoonful Summer in the City. I loved the ability to be commanding and silly, to focus and control a situation, to elevate the mundane into the theatrical. I wanted people to listen, to witness, or simply to notice me. I held people hostage with this need for attention. It was both an imposition and a plea. If the following accounts of my attention-seeking seem dizzying and unrelenting, that's because they were. I was an anxious child, prone as a baby to colic and frequent tears, and later to fist-pounding, leg-kicking tantrums. My mother likened my melodrama to the silent film actress Sarah Bernhardt, as if my frustrations and feelings weren't normal, but calculated, contrived. Bernhardt's excuse for her theatrics was that she had no sound in her films, whereas mine was an effort to drown out an encroaching family muteness. At night, I'd wake up terrified of fire, death, and disease. The smell of toast, my mother in the kitchen and hungry at 3 a.m., wafted upstairs. Smoke signals of distress that hung over my sleep. I checked the pillow to make sure all of my hair wasn't falling out. I researched fire escape ladders and calculated the jump from my second-story bedroom window to the nearest tree branch. I dragged my bedsheets down the hall, sneak into my parents' room, and sleep on the floor. Or I'd crawl into bed with my sister, who would wake up and kick me out. I didn't want to be alone. My brain rarely quieted. In a family video featuring an anniversary message to my grandparents, my voice never falls below the volume of an NFL coach. I won't stop stepping into frame. I didn't want the recording to end. When I was 5 or 6 years old, if my parents had friends over, I would request that I be allowed to sing along to one of my father's records before going to bed. It was a warped, suburban version of the children in The Sound of Music, serenading and charming the adults with So Long, Farewell before their bedtime. Except that I was singing along to the Eagles. A tune likely about cocaine or driving recklessly in a California highway fast lane. We stabbed it with our steely knives, but we just couldn't kill the beast, I yelped, off-key. Lullaby and good night. I bowed, then dragged my baby blanket to my bedroom. I acted as a neighborhood impresario, trying to gather the other children to put on plays or perform hokey talent shows. One summer, we formed Lil D Duran Duran, a Duran Duran cover band, except that we only mimed along to the music. We nailed scrap wood together to form guitars and keyboards and painted them with leftover house paint. Thus, all the instruments were gray. Drawing black squiggly strings with Sharpie pens, the keys on the synthesizer uneven rectangles like a bad set of teeth. We practiced every day on my neighbor's deck. West Coast suburban decks are their own strange art form, elaborate and multi-layered, like wooden wedding cakes. Check out old issues of Sunset Magazine if you want to see how a hot tub might look nestled into a corner or how to plant geraniums between benches for a touch of color. Stain your deck every year. There was a boombox connected to an extension cord that snaked out from the kitchen. The Reflex and Rio blasted on repeat with the help of someone hitting the rewind button. Misty and Ricky, an aged German Shepherd and an Aussie mix, were our only audience. Our drummer, Peter, was hard to track down, even though it was his deck on which we were rehearsing. I was both Simon Le Bon, the lead singer, not lip-syncing but singing along over the music, and also our band's promoter. I asked my dad to photocopy flyers for our show at his office. He obliged. But after 2 weeks of practice, everyone but me lost interest. The members of Lil D returned to other summer activities, catching up on soap operas, front yard water slides fashioned from tarps and a garden hose, tanning while reading B.C. Andrews books, and badminton. In elementary school, our music teacher occasionally designated a day for sharing. Kids would bring in their parents' ABBA records, or we'd sing along to a Beatles song scrubbed clean of drug references. We say hi with a little help from our friends. 1 week, I decided to perform a dance to the McCoy song, Hang On Sloopy. Children, even less so than adults, often have little concept of genre or even of a song's actual meaning. All songs are kids' songs once they hear them. I liked Hang On Sloopy because it sounded like it was a tune about the dog Snoopy, and so I wanted to do a dance for Snoopy, and thus for everyone else in my fifth grade music class. The dance I choreographed, and I use the term choreography loosely, the way you'd call adding milk to cereal cooking, was a combination of marching and punching, and probably resembled aerobics being done by a penguin. I was not graceful. I was coordinated, athletic, and fit, but very gawky. I wore an oversized raspberry-colored t-shirt, the sleeves too long to be called short and too short to be called long, more like flaps. My gangly arms, spiky-haired on account of a misunderstanding I had had about shaving and what body parts to apply a razor to, poked through the sleeves, / tubes, / flaps, like prickly noodles. I tucked the shirt into cream-colored shorts with an elastic band. If not for a fresh knee scab, one might not have been able to tell where my pale legs began and the shorts ended. I can still recall Mrs. Pappas going up to a boy named Braden, whose mouth was only capable of one expression, a smirk, and saying, "Try not to laugh." But I danced anyway. I hung on, like Sloopy. In a junior high government class, our teacher held a mock trial. I played the mother of the accused. The roles were set. A defense attorney, a prosecutor, the witnesses for each side, the judge, the jury. It was a routine classroom exercise that would take up a few days of our time and help the students learn about the judicial process. Our teacher handed out sheets of evidence for the lawyers to consult, while the rest of us sat around, bored, waiting to take the stand and answer a few questions before returning to a slouch posture and watching the clock. Deciding that the event needed an infusion of energy, and dissatisfied with the binary and predictable outcome of the trial, guilty or not guilty, how banal, I decided to stage a confession. I waited for a lull in order to amplify the drama. Then I stood up from my desk and shouted, "My son is innocent! I am the killer!" All heads turned toward me. There was laughter, but I didn't care. My teacher looked dumbfounded as I strolled up to take the stand. This was my trial now. I then extemporized a 10-minute confession that explained where I'd hidden the weapon and outlined my revenge-based motive, all told with a shaky voice and a trembling lower lip. I felt victorious. I had pulled off something both ridiculous and unpredictable. But not everyone was pleased. My classmate Tim, the defense lawyer, took me aside afterward, eyes brimming with tears. He told me that his dad had a brain tumor, and on top of that, I'd just ruined his chances of winning the case. I felt horrible about his father, but vaguely satisfied that I had rescued our class from another mundane afternoon of expected outcomes. As a performer personality seeking attention, this was a frequent intersection of emotions. In high school, I held a series of how-to-host-a-murder parties at my house. In case you are unfamiliar, HTHAM was a series of role-playing mystery games with near-legitimate-sounding names like The Chicago Caper and Grapes of Wrath. I've played almost all of them. The game requires 8 guests. There are 4 male roles and 4 female roles, all of whom are assigned characters, each a suspect in a classic tale of mystery and suspense. One of them, gasp, is the murderer. As a surprise to absolutely no one, not a single male friend of mine ever wanted to participate, so 4 of my girlfriends always had to come to the party dressed in drag. Also unsurprisingly, I took the game very seriously. I sent out the invitation weeks before. I asked that my friends dress up, and costume suggestions were included in the invite. After all, this wasn't a low-rent, fly-by-night, wear-what-you-want-and-add-a-name-tag situation. No, we had to embody our characters. If that meant you had to go to a costume shop to rent a flapper dress or hit up a thrift store for a vintage military uniform, so be it. Bowler hats, swords, briefcases, golf clubs, garter belts, pearls. Yes, to all of it. I didn't slack with my hosting duties either. I got out the special occasion candle holders and polished the silver, onto which I placed pizza bites, piping hot from the microwave. I rinsed off the crystal champagne flutes. To my knowledge, this was the only time they were ever used, and filled them with sparkling cider. For Power and Greed, which took place during the golden age of Hollywood, I replaced our framed family photos with magazine pictures of movie stars from the era. Goodbye to the Brownsteins posing in front of the fireplace, trying to keep our dog Buffy in frame. Hello, Lana Turner. And Elizabeth Taylor and James Stewart looked far more sophisticated than any gap-toothed, mosaic vest-clad school photo my sister or I had ever taken. I even went so far as to autograph the celebrity photos, making the signatures out to the host of this particular game, the towering head of Power Studios, W. Anton Power. Before the festivities began, I banished my father and sister to the TV room. I pressed play on the mixtape I'd made, containing the decade-appropriate music, and dimmed the lights. The guests arrived, and we mingled in character for a while. We gave toasts, ate sliced cheddar atop buttery crackers, and admired one another's outfits and accoutrements. We slow danced, girls with mustaches swaying back and forth with girls in dresses. Then we sat down on Ethan Allen upholstered chairs and solved a murder. I suppose I had reached my limits of mere participation and pretend. I wasn't really creating anything. I was facilitating, implementing, setting up situations that could be both fantastical and fantasy. It was ultimately silly. It was a game. What I loved was the role-playing, the gender ambiguity, the hints of sexiness and bravado, the moments that deviated from the rules and structure. Dressing up and performing allowed me to play at and try on identities, teleporting me into adulthood, into other worlds, into characteristics that would feel foreign in my own skin and my own clothes, but not if I was someone else. I had yet to find the medium or the vessel through which I could harness my anxiety and restlessness, my yearning to be understood, into something both pointed and vast. That shape needed for my creative hunger would come eventually. It took a while for me to get there. But first I should go back and explain how I ended up hanging out with the kind of people who played music. In elementary school, I was confident and thus well-liked, popular even. I was an early-round draft pick for teams in PE class. I won the spelling bee. I attended every crucial water park birthday party and sleepover. I was active in music, sports, and school plays, and I was elected vice president. My campaign speech included lines like, "Girls just want to have fun, but they want to be politicians too," and "We built this city on rock and roll, but we should build this school upon leadership." When I finished talking, I played recorded snippets of all the songs I mentioned, in case anyone had the nerve or cluelessness to miss my clever puns and pop culture references. By sixth grade, I had two best friends, one of whom, Tammy, was the first person I knew whose parents were divorced. She lived with her mom. Tammy was also the first kid I knew who lived in an apartment. At that age, I thought apartments were built specifically to house the single or the newly single, a divorced dormitory of sorts. Tammy was cute and tough, with freckles and an upturned ski jump nose, her bangs bleached tangerine from hydrogen peroxide and sprayed into an upright, frozen wave. Her mom was a smoker, also a rarity to me in the Pacific Northwest suburbs, but I liked the lived-in quality the smell of nicotine brought to their place, a gritty, world-weary sophistication. Plus, we stole her mom's cigarettes so that we could smoke in parks and on weekends. Smoking for me meant blowing outward like you would on a kazoo. In my mind, it still looked cool, and I was too afraid to inhale. I credit this early exposure to cigarettes with removing any desire to be a smoker later in life. Parents, take note. When Tammy arrived at Benjamin Rush Elementary, the rumor was that she had already lost her virginity. She tacitly and vaguely confirmed this to be true, though I still think the whole story might have been fabricated. I figured it might be a case of crafty social maneuvering on her part, a self-mythologizing that is granted to, or required by, kids who transfer schools. Or maybe Tammy was trying to suggest that she had some form of street cred, which is one way a kid with lower economic status gets on equal footing with the middle-class kids. Anything that smelled of real-life experience or hardship, the more exotic and subversive, the better, the comfortable suburban kids held in high esteem. This notion of personal transformation and redefinition is what drew me to Tammy. There was a boldness, a mystery, and a whole lot of not giving a shit. It was Tammy who orchestrated my first kisses and makeouts. Together we attended summer camp. Me, so I could shoot bows and arrows, sing Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle and Around, and make lanyards. Her, so she could meet boys from other schools and gargle with someone else's tongue. Eventually, I decided that holding hands with a guy in a turtleneck and shorts in the middle of the woods and dancing to Depeche Mode in the mess hall was more fun than canoeing or collecting clams on the beach, though it was always in the back of my mind that I hadn't showered or been able to go to the bathroom for over 5 days. After camp, on a springtime backyard tent sleepover, Tammy arranged for a group of boys to sneak in. She instructed each of us, paired us up, and told us how to use our tongues when we kissed, which as a preteen is an unrelenting technique that requires one's mouth to be open longer and wider than during a dental exam. Tammy zipped herself into a sleeping bag with a boy. The rest of us were sitting upright, not sure what to do horizontally, and thus not wanting to commit to one person. We traded kisses in a humid tent that smelled of Dracar Noir, cigarettes, and mint liqueur. Almost immediately, I cut the lips of a kid named Ricky with my braces. I retired for the night. I felt inept at this carefree, outdoorsy group sexiness, but I made an eager, loyal follower. I liked being part of a gang. Jennifer was my other friend. She had an older brother named Michael, whose heavy metal tape collection I admired. Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, Van Halen. More important, however, her aunt worked for Huey Lewis. Jennifer had a framed picture of him in the house. That fact alone was enough for her family to seem magical to me. My connection to this rock star with countless hits on the radio and whose albums I owned was clearly tenuous. It was my friend's aunt, whom I never met and who didn't live in Redmond and who possibly was no longer working for Huey Lewis or for the news. Maybe she had done a job for him at some point, or she had talked about working for him. Maybe she had wanted to. Maybe she was employed by someone but not by Huey Lewis. Maybe, like me, she was a fan of his album, Sports. The facts were mutable and hard to pin down, but there was that framed photo. And that was something, something real. And I had been in the house with that photo. And that person in the photo was famous. These are the ways fans maneuver through the world, with flimsy connections and strong hopes. Despite all the sleepovers or the sneaking out to drape toilet paper over someone's house or the weeks at summer camp together, Tammy, Jennifer, and I drifted apart once we entered junior high. But they were my cohorts during my happiest childhood years, the ones during which my mom was healthy and present enough to help me with my homework, not to mention that ridiculous election speech, and when it didn't seem odd that my dad bought a motorcycle and drove off to Canyonlands on a vacation with a male buddy. Chapter 3. Disappearance. I first heard the term anorexic in the backseat of a car on the way home from the movies. It was the summer before seventh grade. From the burgundy insides of a Chevy Blazer, we all turned to look at a jogger, a woman, a sinewy form devoid of curves, angles only, rib cage and clavicles protruding, like some sort of moving body diagram, inside out. The driver of the car, my friend's mother, said the word that we did not know. What it described was what we had just seen, a skeleton in Nikes. The word anorexia was like a prize I had won in a drawing someone entered for me on my behalf. Unexpected, sure, but I would find a use for it. And I did. At the dinner table, I inserted it into the conversation. I added it to the lyrics of popular songs and sang them while my mother slowly pushed her food around a plate, rarely lifting the fork to her mouth, every morsel a lame horse on a track, never reaching the finish line. I taunted my mother with the word, as if anorexia were something she might desire, not something she already had. My mother was fair-skinned, with a delicate, bony strand of a nose and dark, straight hair. Her eyes were a deep brown, and I think of her as unblinking, as if she were always looking at something suspended between horror and sadness. She smiled with a strained, hesitant warmth. In the years before my mother's illness, it's not her body that I recall being different, though obviously it was. Her cheeks fuller and brighter, her hair shinier, her breasts and stomach softer. But rather her presence. She was noticeable. She was in the car and in the kitchen, putting curlers in her hair and shopping for clothes, talking with her friends, helping me with my homework, attending school plays, walking, talking, sitting, eating, being, existing. In a photo from several years later, the last family vacation we would ever take, my mother is standing on the beach in Hawaii, bikini clad, burnt red like she'd been dipped in cherry Kool-Aid, bags of white pus forming on her sternum, bones for days. Thin, brittle hair. It had been falling out for a while now. Hollow eyes and cheeks. She is somewhere between rotting and a fossil. Maybe she hoped that the smaller she got, the easier it would be to disappear. After consulting a doctor and nutritionist, and probably not at all on account of my singing or tormenting, my mother finally did admit, to us, to her friends, to herself, that she was ill. And when I was 14, she checked herself into an eating disorder unit at a hospital in Ballard. She would be gone nearly a month. For the first 2 weeks my mom was away, our kitchen was stocked with covered dishes prepared for my father, sister, and me by various women at my dad's law firm. Casseroles, mostly. Heat and serve. If you saw our crowded fridge, it might look like we were preparing for a big party, like the Super Bowl, or an unnamed celebration where the family stuffed themselves while their wife or mother is in the hospital on account of starving herself. There was a dish consisting of tortilla chips, cheese, chicken, and a cream of something cream-colored, the final ingredient being the only one distinguishing it from nachos. This became our instant favorite. My dad learned how to make the tortilla casserole. We alternated those nights with bagel dogs, soft pretzels, or tamales from Costco, and we soon realized we might be able to survive on our own. In hindsight, I'm glad we had this time to practice. Meanwhile, at junior high school and among my peers, I was mildly enjoying the attention that having a mother in the hospital granted me. An illness in the family felt like the currency I needed to make myself more interesting. In home economics class, we watched health movies that addressed the concerns of body dysmorphia, a TV special called Little Miss Perfect, and one about bulimia, Kate's Secret, starring Meredith Baxter Burney. I felt as knowledgeable as the teacher and acted accordingly. I broke down the differences between binging and purging. I explained what Ipecac was. And yes, I said with a hint of disbelief, bulimics sometimes hide bags of vomit under their beds. My mom was 88 pounds and anorexic, but apparently I had the market cornered on all eating disorders. I wasn't the prettiest or the smartest one in school. I was desperate for a clear role among my friends, and now I had one. I was someone they felt sorry for. I also had a newfound status on the carpool circuit. I rode shotgun everywhere. While my friends were in the back seat discussing bra sizes and boys, I sat in the front and listened while their mothers opened up about a recent MS diagnosis, spousal drinking, and kitchen remodels. Trash compactors, skylights. My own mother's condition was a floodgate. Apparently now I could understand something that these women's daughters could not. We traded diseases and misfortunes, swapped them like baseball cards. I stared at the car radio knobs or the fading five of the gear shift, empathically nodding my head with the certainty of a scrubs-wearing career nurse on a lunch break. It will be a long struggle, yes. You'll get through it. As my friends embarked on adolescence, developing what seemed to be a natural, God-given talent for makeup and hair removal, my nose grew too big, my gums appeared to be sliding down my two front teeth, and my chest and back remained indistinguishable from each other. I felt the confidence of my younger self slipping away, but that didn't matter to their moms. And I imagine it was they who kept me on invite lists to birthday parties, weekend ski trips, and after-school mall excursions. After all, who else among their kids' friends was mature enough to understand the nuanced joys of a recently procured coffee table book on the Kennedys, or the acquisition of a delicious chocolate fondue recipe? Plus, I was their number one source for scene-by-scene summaries of films they were too harried to see. I stood next to them in the kitchen while they unloaded the dishwasher, sipping lemonade, casually leaning against the counter or sitting atop it, retelling the plots of Clue and Romancing the Stone from title sequence to end credits. Meanwhile, my friend worked on homework or chatted on the phone in the other room. That was child's play. I felt adult, important. When a friend's father died of Lou Gehrig's disease, her mother counted me among the first to be notified. I was getting ready for school when I received the call. I took the news like a pro. No tears. When was the funeral? Did they need anything? Later, in the school bathroom during lunch, I delivered the story to our other friends with the gravity and stoicism of a nightly news anchor. Here were the facts. They wept streams of turquoise mascara while I stood near the paper towel dispenser and let them know that this was just how things were. This was life. Tough it out. But the reality of my mom being in the eating disorders unit was far less glamorous and a lot more painful. There was little to brag about. My parents grew up in the Chicago area, my father in Evanston, my mother in Skokie. They met at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign when my dad was in law school and my mom was an undergrad. For their wedding anniversary, they drove a VW bus to Seattle, the city where I would be born. I know very little about my parents' childhoods. The historical facts are hazy and scattered. My father's dad was a doctor, his mother a housewife. Dr. and Mrs. Stanley Brownstein, said the return address on the birthday and Valentine's Day cards we received from them, containing either a $5 bill or a $5 check. My mother's parents were less well off. Her father was an accountant, then a comptroller in the auto industry. Her mother was a teacher. Before my father sold my childhood home in Redmond to move to Seattle, I dug through boxes in the garage, salvaging old books and photos. I found letters my father and mother had written back and forth when they were engaged. He was working for the Washington State DA, and she was still in college. My mother's notes were sweet and longing. She expressed a yearning to be reunited, to be out of Illinois, to start a life. My father wrote considerate but formal responses, largely about his job and the Pacific Northwest. At holidays, descriptions of relatives were not about how they lived, but rather how they died. My paternal grandmother would point to the faces and pictures and rattle off every kind of cancer you could think of, and ones you couldn't think of. I'd tune into stories about our family, hoping to glean insight, only to have them quickly be disputed and left unfinished. Someone might mention an older brother or baby, a vacation they once embarked on, a profession or a hobby, but the conversation inevitably and quickly devolved into a debate about the meaning of second cousins versus first cousins once removed. We never settled that debate, nor did I ever learn any solid information about my relatives or my family's past. These convivial but otherwise circuitous talks are likely why my dad's brother, Uncle Mike, often stepped up as the family storyteller and entertainer. When I was younger, my uncle was a thrice-married plastic surgeon. He's now with his fourth wife, my Aunt Denise, who had become one of the first and foremost sexual reassignment surgeons in America, specializing in top surgery for female-to-male transgender people. He was also, and still is, a life member of the NRA as well as a benefactor member, and he has voted conservative in every major election. He was passionate about all of it, despite how strange this combination of traits might have appeared to others. A typical Thanksgiving involved him describing how a clitoris could be elongated into a penis, or trying to explain the notion of transgender to a great aunt who resembled a drag queen, her bony fingers drenched in costume jewelry, clicking like a tap shoe routine as she gestured, hands flying up in the air to emphasize her bewilderment. One Thanksgiving, my sister and cousin and I played catch with a silicone breast implant my uncle had lying around, while the movie Scarface played on the TV in the background. Another Thanksgiving, my grandmother sat at the dining table with taut skin and visible staples in her head from a recent facelift courtesy of one son, while the other son carved into the turkey with an electric knife. Our family liked to focus on activities instead of communication. So when we weren't tossing around fake breasts or staging photos of relatives snorting flour off the counter to look like cocaine, we got the guns out. When my grandfather retired from medicine, he and my grandmother moved to Tucson, Arizona, which is where he developed an interest in collecting firearms and going to the shooting range. The grandkids loved to pose for pictures on the backyard brick patio, the bright orange Tucson sun, and cactus-covered landscape behind us, our unloaded weapons pointed at the camera, or more likely, right at each other. Though my family didn't talk much to one another, we did talk about one another. My dad's parents would refer to their daughter-in-law as her or she, talking as if my mother were invisible, even though she sat right there at the table. "Does she ever eat?" they would say to my father. "Does she know how skinny she looks?" I suppose we were better observers than communicators. We were all subjects to be worried over, complained about, even adored, but never quite people to be held or loved. There was an intellectual, almost absurd distance. The ways that oddity and detachment intersected in the family might best be summed up in the story of the family dog. Buffy, a 40-pound golden retriever mix we adopted from the pound when I was 6 and my sister was 3, had been smothered with love in her youth. Buffy, for whom we took a pet first aid class in order to learn how to be responsible owners, who was the muse for my grade school poetry exercises, Buffy is Fluffy, our sidekick for picnics and outings, on the sidelines for soccer games, and the subject most featured in my first roll of film, posing on my baby blanket and wearing sunglasses, after I was given a camera for my birthday. Buffy, who followed us around the cul-de-sacs while we engaged in dirt-clawed fights with the neighbor kids, and trotted after us while we rode big wheels and eventually bikes. Buffy, who suffered the sting of the archaic idea that you could punish a dog by smacking it on the nose with a rolled-up newspaper, and whose tail was run over by my mother as she backed the car out of the driveway. And Buffy, turned back into a stray in her own home on account of the rest of us surrendering to emptiness, drifting away from anything we could call familiar, her skin itching and inflamed, covered with sores and bites, like tattoos, like skywriting, screaming with redness as if to say, "Please, please, pet me." But we didn't. When we decided to put her down, not because she was sick, but because she was old and neglected, a remnant of a family we no longer recognized, my father asked my sister to do it. My sister was 16. She drove the dog to the vet one day after school by herself. No one else said goodbye. The distance and detachment created a loneliness. We couldn't name the source of it, but there was a blankness around which we gathered, one that grew colder and darker and seeped into everything we did. I think for my mother, it was most pronounced. I would lie in bed at night and hear her on the phone with my father, who was away for weeks on business in Europe or Asia or Australia. She was crying, scared, frustrated, lonely. Her anxiety made her brittle, easy to anger. But I didn't feel sympathetic. I felt fear, neglect. I felt resentment. My mother and I started to fight all the time. She was retreating from the world, a slow-motion magic trick. Meanwhile, I was getting louder, angrier, wilder. I experimented with early forms of my own amplification, of self, of voice, of fury, while my mother's volume was turned down lower and lower, only ever audible when she broadcast searing feedback and static, broken, tuneless sounds. We vacillated between shouting and silence, the megaphone and the mute. We scrapped and scraped. I'd rile her up until medicine bottles were hurled my way, and I responded with a piece of pizza. She threatened to wear a raincoat in the house so she could deal with all of the flying shit. Everything was a projectile, an indoor hailstorm. The first time we visited my mother in the eating disorder unit of the hospital, the thing she thought to warn us about was not her own condition, but that some of the other patients shopped at thrift stores and that we shouldn't judge. Her upwardly mobile sense of middle-class decorum was still intact, despite the fact that her clothing drooped, almost slithered off her body, as if it were seeking elsewhere to perch, looking hardly different on her than it would on a wire hanger. In her concern and preoccupation over how we might handle the class and lifestyle differences in the EDU, she neglected to mention that her roommate in the hospital was my exact age. Brianna was a goth, a cool city kid with black hair, blunt bangs, and a knack for liquid eyeliner. She might have been the exact kind of girl I'd be friends with, or who I'd want to actually be, but right now she was my mom's friend and confidant. While I had discussed my mom's illness with my friend's parents, I had never thought to talk about it with my own mother, and now there was a surrogate in me. Brianna could share and understand the one thing about my mother that I never could, her disease. Later, after they were both released, they'd hang out and watch movies together, grown-up movies like the film adaptation of Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping that I had no interest in. I felt sophomoric and callow, but I was only 14. Plus, I didn't want a friend. I wanted a mom. Like any part of a hospital, an eating disorder unit has a smell. The smell is like a color that doesn't have a recognizable hue, an Easter egg dipped into every kind of dye until it possesses an unnamed ugliness. It is beige, it is skin, it is bile. The EDU smelled like protein-rich powder supplements and chemical cleaners, like a hot, stinging exhale of despair. Visiting hours consisted of filling in my mom about our lives, attending group therapy, taking walks through the hallways, and participating in activities like ceramics, where we'd glaze clay dinosaurs and mugs to take home with us later. Souvenirs. It was hard not to stare at the shapes that surrounded us. A girl whose body was so emaciated that she was covered in a layer of fine hair, walking near another woman whose skin had stretched and stretched to contain some bottomless need, a self-hugging device, a house. The bulimics scared me the least, so I focused my attention on them. They looked relatively healthy on the outside, as long as you didn't look too closely at their vomit-stained teeth. Puberty was a confusing time to be around so many women whose bodies had become a sort of battleground. My own relationship to food was healthy. I was lean and athletic with a high metabolism. I could eat half a pizza with a side of breadsticks and wash it down with soda. I never dieted or denied myself food. But there were ways in which I started to disconnect from my body during this time. That's where the sadness was. Not just mine, but these other women's as well. I lodged myself firmly in my head. It was the only way to process all that I witnessed at the EDU, those halls of hungry ghosts. In my vast experience of visiting hospitals, I've noticed that part of the job of being a visitor is to make a show of looking healthy and able, running around, skipping, laughing really loud, having a big appetite, illustrating athletic prowess. Otherwise, it's as if a doctor or nurse or psychiatrist might look at you and decide that you have to check in and stay, or that the vulnerability, heartache, and fear will leave you open to illness. You'll enter healthy and leave enervated, or not leave at all. A visitor can't show weakness. Thus, my sister and I played very competitive ping pong in the common room for everyone to see and to hear. Look at us. Nothing wrong at all. It was almost like we had dropped in to play a pickup game and there just happened to be a bunch of sick people in the hospital.